WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Tuesday, May 30th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. After months of drama, the debt ceiling deal is finally done. Maybe. And few seem to be happy about it. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is one of them. On Saturday, he announced that Republican and Democratic negotiators have finally hammered out a deal to raise the debt limit, a deal that also includes conditions to rein in out-of-control government spending.
And after weeks of negotiations, we have come to an agreement in principle. We still have a lot of work to do, but I believe this is an agreement in principle that's worthy of the American people. It has historic reductions in spending, consequential reforms that will lift people out of poverty into the workforce, rein in government overreach. There are no new taxes, no new government programs. There's a lot more within the bill. We still have more work to do tonight to finish all the writing of it. I do want to take a moment, though. I do want to thank Garrett Graves and Patrick McHenry for all their work on this and for all the work that we're going to continue to do tonight. I know you'll have a lot of questions. I'm not going to take them tonight. Out of respect, I want to brief our members about where we currently are. I expect to finish the writing of the bill, checking with the White House and speaking to the President again tomorrow afternoon, and then posting the text of it tomorrow, and then be voting on it on Wednesday.
The agreement authorizes another $4 trillion in debt over the next 2 years, a massive sum, in exchange for concessions like restarting student loan repayments within 60 days, applying the $40 billion of unspent COVID money to the debt, cutting non-military spending back to fiscal year 2022 levels, disallowing any new taxes, and limiting top-line federal spending to 1% annual growth for the next 6 years. Among the agreement's more appealing features are its repeal of funding for thousands of extra IRS agents and new work requirements for people who receive government food aid. The agreement is already under fire from both sides of the aisle. No less a neocon than Lindsey Graham is vowing to defeat the measure because it slashes military spending just when we need a stronger military.
Before we get to that, I want to talk about your reaction to the budget deal as we now understand it, because based on your tweets, you do not think that the defense spending part of this is a good deal because it essentially gives the president what he was asking for in his budget when it comes to defense spending.
Yeah, well, number one, I respect Kevin McCarthy. I want to raise the debt ceiling. It'd be irresponsible not to do it. I want to control spending. I'd like to have a smaller IRS. I'd like to claw back the unused COVID money. And I know you can't get the perfect, but what I will not do is adopt the Biden defense budget and call it a success. Kevin said that the defense is fully funded. If we adopt the Biden defense budget, it increases defense spending below inflation. 3.2% increase in defense is below inflation. The Biden defense budget takes the Navy from 298 ships to 291 at a time when China is going to increase their Navy by almost a third. So the Biden defense budget was a joke before, and if we adopt it as Republicans, we will be doing a great disservice to the party of Ronald Reagan.
For others on Capitol Hill, such as Senator Rand Paul, the bottom line of more new debt is a deal breaker. On Sunday, Paul tweeted, "Fake conservatives agree to fake spending cuts. Deal will increase mandatory spending about 5%, increase military spending about 3%, and maintain current non-military discretionary spending at post-COVID levels. No real cuts to see here. Conservatives have been sold out once again." Florida Governor and presidential candidate Ron DeSantis told Fox News that the deal doesn't do enough to change America's fiscal course. He said that after this deal, America will still be careening towards bankruptcy. Among the staunchest of constitutionalists in the House, Texas Congressman Chip Roy, who delivered a passionate speech late last week urging his colleagues to hold the line, he has already indicated that he doesn't support the bill. "It's not a good deal," Roy wrote on Twitter, "some $40 trillion in debt for, at best, a two-year spending freeze and no serious substantive policy reforms." Given all of the opposition among GOP and some Democrats, it's completely possible that this will not pass through Congress.
When we read the text of the bill that we presented back on August 26th to the Senate, it was a conservative bill. It wasn't all that we wanted as conservatives, but it got the trajectory of spending down. It had actual year one cuts, and it had a limit on the debt ceiling. When we examined the details, it was anything but that. Now, the fight in January with Kevin McCarthy was that he would fight for conservatism. It was his words that said debt is the single biggest threat to America. Not only did he not fight, he surrendered the details of our bill. And so the only people that are happy with this bill, only factions that are happy, are China, which is buying up more of our debt, and the Biden administration, which we're now seeing is a corrupt administration that will spin this country into oblivion. We're not going to have it. Now, as far as the Rules Committee, we will look at it. We will see what amendments can be offered. If it's a closed rule, meaning no amendments, and accept what we saw in print, it's a no-go for a lot of us.
So joining me to discuss today's stories is Executive Senior Editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Paul. So, happy post-Memorial Day.
Well, yes, happy post-Memorial Day. You know what I liked about this deal that I heard is, does this mean that we're going to, those 87,000 or however many IRS agents that they were planning to throw into the mix is not going to happen?
Okay, well, I mean, even though the bill is only 99 pages, it's not a bill, it's sort of an outline for a bill. So it's only 99 pages, which is gratifying, but there's still a lot of stuff that needs to be unpackaged. And I confess, I did not spend my Labor Day or my Memorial Day holiday reading
you
this
did
bill.
It.
I did not. I did not. I mean, I was following news stories. But anyway, from what I can gather, out of the roughly $80 billion that is used to fund this mammoth organization, the IRS, they propose to cut something like $1.9 billion, mm-hmm. which is a drop in the bucket. But McCarthy does maintain that this, in fact, would cover the salaries of all of these contemplated new, you know, several tens of thousands of IRS agents that they're hoping to hire. I don't know why they couldn't simply hire them anyway and reallocate the funds in some different way. I mean, you know, typically people who favor the IRS, the statists, as some like to call them, you know, they find a way of getting their way. So, you know, it's not clear. You know, that said, overall, I mean, how to unpackage this? I mean, we're hearing two dramatically different stories. On the one hand, and we didn't really, perhaps in fairness to Kevin McCarthy, we should say that he is maintaining, perhaps with some accuracy, that this is the largest rescission ever made on the part of Congress in our history. I think if we go back to the Jacksonian era, we might be able to quibble with that because during that period and that period alone, America actually paid off its debt entirely. That was a major priority of President Andrew Jackson in his second term in office, and he actually achieved it. And that's the only time post-founding that we have done that. Okay, and then as soon as he left office, the debts came back, right? Although obviously not the vertiginous levels that we have today. So I'm not sure that that's true in the face of it, but certainly in recent times, probably McCarthy has a point in the sense that for the first time, there isn't yet another massive hike in spending. He pointed out in several interviews that, you know, when the Republicans have controlled both houses in the White House, they've always broken their promises. They've never even made cosmetic cuts. They've always talked the talk and ended up raising.
And that's true, right?
And that is true. So in this case, I mean, obviously people like Rand Paul and a lot of other folks in Congress say, well, this isn't enough. This doesn't even rise to the level of the bill that the House passed back in April, a couple months ago, which also was not enough, but it was what they felt they could all agree on, mm-hmm. sort of a minimum. And this falls significantly short of that. But that said, I mean, there are some things to like about it.
Like what?
Well,
What about the loan forgiveness? Is that going away too?
Well, the loan forgiveness apparently you mean the student loan forgiveness?
Yes.
So apparently, if it becomes a bill and is passed more or less in the current form, it will, after 60 days from the time of passage, will require people to start making payments on their student loans again. Yeah. Whether they will actually choose to do so is a different story.
And that's been a major on halt issue for now, right?
Mm-hmm. Because of it has been for several years.
Lower court
I mean, they
decisions.
Also went out. I mean, and this is, you know, not really significant anymore when we've become accustomed to talk in terms of trillions of dollars rather than billions of dollars. I mean, once upon a time in the 60s, I forget who it was, one of our senators made this epigrammatic statement to the effect that, you know, $1 billion here and $1 billion there, and soon you're talking about real money. It's sort of a joke, right? And today, I suppose, instead of billion, we're in the trillions. You know, yeah. We have real money. So, in view of that, there are some tens of billions of dollars that were set aside for COVID, basically to underwrite all those checks that they were sending out to people during the COVID period, all that stuff. That's still sitting because people didn't claim checks and because they anyway. So I think I've heard $40-50 billion. No one knows exactly how much.
Yeah.
A drop in the bucket, but in theory, that's all going to be returned now and used to actually pay for expenses.
I could use $40 billion.
Well, as could all of us mere mortals. But
yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, you know, that they're returning the levels of spending back to 2022, which is still post-COVID and is still extravagant, which is why it's been pointed out, well, you know, this isn't nearly enough. If we continue on the new trajectory that this bill has put us on, we're still careering towards the cliff of bankruptcy.
And that's accurate, right?
Yeah, it is. On the positive side, and again, in limited fairness to McCarthy, he does point out that the Republicans, if you want to call the Republicans the good guys, you know, control the House only. They don't control the Senate. Mm-hmm. They don't obviously the White House. So there are some limitations now. But then people come back and say, well, okay.
Well, they can hold it up.
Well, that's the point. And people are saying, well, then you should just not blink. You should say, okay, fine. We'll let the country default. See how you like it. And that's an issue on which, you know, honest people can and do disagree. McCarthy is saying this is only the first step. And that, you know, of course, the implication is once we get control of the Senate and the White House after next year, then we'll really be serious spending cuts. I don't know. And obviously, it's impossible to know how much of even what he's done is a result of his feet being held to the fire by the more obstreperous elements of the Republican side. So, you know, that. And there's another point I wanted to mention, you know, that bothers me. And that is this insistence on using the word conservative. And you can pretty much sort out the neocons or people on the Republican side that are verging into that in that direction when they use a word like conservative. You don't hear Chip Roy or Marjorie Taylor Greene using that term.
Yeah, they mean the establishment, the rhinos, huh?
Well, I mean, the thing is, what does conservative even mean? It's one of these words that's so vacuous. It can be made to mean whatever people want.
Anything to the right of Joe Manchin.
When we get to the point where people say, well, I don't know if this bill is constitutional or not, then I'll take them more seriously. But as long as this term conservative continues to be bruited about as being the litmus test for everything that's good or bad in legislative terms.
It's not a good standard, right?
It's not. It is a false standard. And it has been, I mean, this isn't new to Kevin McCarthy. This has been around for decades. It goes back at least to the 1950s. You know, Russell Kirk's famous book, The Conscience of, I think he wrote The Conscience of the Conservative Mind or something like that. And The Conscience of the Conservative, I forget who wrote that one. But this term has been popularized by what we now call the neocons. And it's not a good thing. If we're really going to change things, we need to go back to constitutional limits. Mm-hmm. And that can't be done overnight. I understand that, you know.
Yeah.
But that needs to be the goal, not being more conservative.
Real quick, if this bill doesn't make it in this form, is it going to be because of the Democrats or Republicans?
Could be both. And that's a major point. We could be jumping the gun here. It's not even clear whether this bill will pass. We may yet end up in a semi-crisis. I don't think it'll be as acute as people are claiming, but it may or may not pass by June 5th.
Well, we'll certainly be keeping an eye on this. Thank you, Steve. Stay tuned, folks, because after this, we'll be looking at a story that includes an Antifa activist whose twisted message and cancel tactics are benefiting from your tax dollars. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Here at The New American, we are excited to cover the World Council on Health's The Better Way Conference in Bath, UK. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko will be there reporting live, and she'll be hosting two panel discussions. Please visit betterwayconference.org to get your tickets. Now to the rest of our stories. A recent report from MRC Free Speech America reveals that the Biden administration awarded $40 million in grant money to various groups to combat domestic terrorism. This administration has repeatedly lied that white supremacy is the largest domestic threat. So it should be no surprise that at least one beneficiary of your money is an Antifa member whose agenda is to completely deplatform so-called fascists and outright Nazis off the internet, as well as prevent them from gathering in public. We'll look at this twisted logic shortly. The Department of Homeland Security, led by either a very incompetent or very subversive secretary, awarded 80 grants through the Terrorism Prevention Grant Program. The report from MRC Free Speech America reveals that DHS awarded the University of Dayton in Ohio $352,000 to create the Radical Prevents O program, which claims to draw on the expertise of the University of Dayton faculty for the purpose of combating domestic violence, extremism, and hate movements. This program put on seminars with lectures by people like Michael Lowenthal, a University of Cincinnati research fellow, the executive director of the Peace and Justice Studies Association, and an open Antifa member. Here he is talking as one of the featured speakers at a taxpayer-funded seminar titled White Nationalism Workshop.
We organized largely through networks. Today, people would call Antifa. At the time, it was known as Anti-Racist Action. And the basic premise is to follow white supremacists where they go, to outnumber them, and then to physically confront them, to deny them the space to physically meet in public. This is the idea of deplatforming.
In his presentation, Lowenthal showed a pyramid that lumps mainstream conservative groups on the same chart with legitimate militant neo-Nazis. The Antifa professor did say that the people they are after are the ones on the top of the pyramid, not on the bottom. This chart was, among others, included in the original grant application that the University of Dayton submitted to DHS to get funding. As you can see, the bottom two levels of the pyramid include enough organizations to represent every American who is right of Joe Manchin, from your run-of-the-mill Fox News viewer to your Christian broadcast follower to anyone who's MAGA. The New American's parent company, the John Birch Society, is also included in that bottom grouping. Speaking of, we'll have more recent news of leftist attacks against the JBS in a moment. So these people who are deemed experts on domestic terrorism have a conveniently elastic definition of bigotry. And they push the idea that if you believe that there exists an international conspiracy, you're a bigot. Here's Patrick Ahern, a senior lecturer at the University of Dayton, explaining that anti-Semitism is conveniently coded, the perfect excuse to accuse anyone you don't like of hate.
Anti-Semitism appears in often coded, not meanings like it does on the left, but coded language such as Hollywood, elites, intellectuals, when the need serves. And the imagery of the Jew is especially fungible in that you have the devious, powerful, bent on domination, as well as the ultimately weak, right? The oxymoronic notion of the communist banker that has the specter of communism and the dark side, the usury capitalism.
Also, here's the Antifa professor, Lowenthal, explaining when it's okay to deny Americans their basic First Amendment rights.
Basically, deplatforming is denying far-right fascist folk any sort of public sphere access. Denying them the ability to speak. Because the belief is, the argument is that hate speech is more than speech. It's materiality, it's organizing, it's mobilization. It's not an exchange of ideas in the marketplace and the best one wins, it's something else. It's the strategic deployment of organizational energy and power. And so to deny people that, to shut down their websites, to close their meetings, to physically prevent them from assembling in public.
Lowenthal was also very instructive. He illustrated how he and his Antifa cohorts worked to ruin the lives of those they believe to be fascists.
And so what do anti-fascists do with this info? And again, I just kind of implied, but and I'm not saying that everyone pictured here is an anti-fascist. I'm speaking more generally about deplatforming. But you know, we contact employers, landlords, commanding officers, school officials, family, clergy. Family is a tricky one, but it is important. And we pressure service providers. And by pressure, I don't mean like intimidate and threaten. I just mean like let them know that this is what's being done. And typically on a kind of 2021 CYA, I want to appear like a loving social justice corporation, people will kick people off. So these are all successful campaigns. GoFundMe, Patreon, PayPal, and Venmo, which is how people monetize their hate. We have made that really hard to do.
In the seminars, Lowenthal also discussed how so-called anti-fascists can physically infiltrate groups, not just online. Both seminars were posted on YouTube more than a half a year ago. They've managed to garner a paltry 3,500 views altogether. All the comments have been posted over the last 5 days, indicating that if it weren't for this recent reporting with hyperlinks to this drivel, nobody would have seen it. The silver lining is that not a single agreeable comment has been posted. Another indicator that Americans aren't buying this anti-white, anti-conservative Kool-Aid. One person who commented on the seminar said, "Ready to burn my diploma from the University of Dayton." A perfect example of the biggest problem we have in America today, the functionally mentally ill disguised as college professors. Another person wrote, "Any professor spewing this garbage should be stripped of all certifications, diplomas, etc., and be relegated to the janitorial staff." The irony is that by forging any partnership with the government to silence and banish people from the economy for thought crimes makes them the actual fascists. Once again, we have a case of whatever they accuse others of doing, they're the ones actually doing it. And speaking of leftist vigilante groups, leftist historian Matthew Dalek revealed in his new book that the Anti-Defamation League infiltrated the John Birch Society decades ago to disrupt our work. Dalek has said the ADL probably even committed illegal acts in its attempt to disrupt our work. Dalek has written the book, Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right, an unfavorable look at the parent organization of the New American. Here he is in an interview with NPR's Terry Gross on May 17.
So what did the Anti-Defamation League do to infiltrate the Birchers? Did they send out representatives who pretended to be interested in joining the society, interested in becoming active in it?
Yeah, I think all of the above. The agents had, they were agents. They had code names, Boss Number 2, Boss Number 4, short for Boston. I don't know their real names. Some of them, one of them pretended to be a chapter leader from New Jersey who was just in town visiting headquarters to pick up literature. Other times they were interested in joining the society. Some posed as white supremacists or as out and out racists. Really it ran the gamut.
It's surprising that the FBI and its leader, J. Edgar Hoover, worked in part with the Anti-Defamation League to infiltrate the John Birch Society. It's surprising because, I mean, Hoover himself was so conservative and reactionary.
The justification for this infiltration was to obstruct the work of a purportedly anti-Semitic group. The only problem was that the JBS was never anti-Semitic. Here's Dalek admitting that, while performing acrobatic acts of intellectual dishonesty in trying not to disrupt a lie the media has perpetuated for decades.
Yeah. Is it fair to just say that we're racist?
Well, so this was actually a huge debate in the 1960s, and it's, I think, an ongoing debate about the far right. The Birch Society denied emphatically that they were racist, and they denied emphatically that they were anti-Semitic. They pointed to the existence of a handful of African Americans and Jewish Americans who were members of the movement. And it's true that they did have some Jewish Americans. They had some African Americans in the Birch Society. They also occasionally tried to police their ranks. So I found memos, for example, in which someone had written in to the Birch Society and said that the real problem in the United States is the Jews, and that the Jews are behind the communist plot against America, and basically urging the society to become more anti-Semitic. Well, someone in headquarters wrote, "Is this guy anti-Semitic or what?" And then someone else wrote on this memo, "He's a wild man, drop him."
What do you think, Steve?
Well, yeah, I mean, that those last words that he uttered are accurate. I mean, the John Birch Society, And I speak as one who's traveled widely over the years, met many, many members across the country. These are decent, decent people.
Yeah.
Perfect? No, we're not perfect. And occasionally do we get members who are, who need to be
kicked out?
Yes, obviously. Do we occasionally get members who are good and then become, you know, distracted by something and need to leave? That happens too. But by and large, the people who are the pullers at the oars in our organization are just la creme de la creme. Very, very, you know, morally fine people above reproach of many different religions, of many different ethnic groups. I mean, right here in Wisconsin, we have people ethnically Asian and so forth who are members of the Birch Society and who are very active. So, this old canard about Birchers being, you know, white racists was false. From
it was
the
always
get-go.
False, yeah.
Always false. But,
and you can see, I mean, I listened to that interview, I read the transcript and whatnot, and this is always hard for these folks who actually, once they do a little digging, they realize that it's not the case, but they still have to bend to the media. And that's what I realized with this. It's like, but they were racist, right? And he was like, he makes us racist by the fact that their association with that others agreed with our literature or whatever. So that's obviously very, very intellectually dishonest. One last thing. It seems like, based on the other previous story, that what we have developing is that anyone who is seen as believing in the international conspiracy is going to end up being labeled a bigot or an anti-Semite. That seems to be the narrative.
Well, and sure, and that goes back to the whole Prodigals of the Elders of Zion from the late 19th century and the early 20th century, where some hoaxsters out there wrote this thing that purported to be, you know, the secret writings of this evil Jewish globalist cabal. And many Americans at the day, including Henry Ford, believed it, accepted it as genuine. Of course, we know that Adolf Hitler believed it too, or professed to believe it, and the rest is history, as we say. So that became a very, very appealing and convenient brush with which to tar, you know, the pro-American so-called right wing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, do you think the idea is just that, is just to shut the conversation down? If you know there's an international conspiracy, we're going to shut you down. Thanks, Steve. Well, that's all for our news segment today. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because after this, Alex Newman discusses the latest World Health Organization plot of massive power grab that implicates your country, liberty, family, and health. We'll see you right after this.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
Folks, we've been warning you here on this program for over a year now about a deep state power grab through the World Health Organization to basically consolidate global control over not just health, but everything using the World Health Organization. And how do I know it's everything? Well, because they've told us that climate change is a global health emergency. Racism is a health emergency. Gun violence is a health emergency, right? Literally everything is a health emergency if you take these globalist totalitarian deep staters seriously. And so now they are actually having this meeting. They're meeting in Geneva right now. They started last week, if you're watching us as we release this. And they're negotiating a few different things. One of the things they're doing is they're working on this international pandemic accord, which... it was called the International Pandemic Treaty. When they realized they were never going to get it through the Senate, they had to do some rebranding. Of course, the Senate has to ratify things with two-thirds in favor. And so they've now called it an accord, hoping that it won't have to be ratified by the U.S. Senate so that it won't go down in flames. They're also continuing to work on amendments to the international health regulations. This is another way that they hope to bypass the U.S. Senate so that this can be considered ratified automatically. Now, they already approved some amendments. Some of them are terrible, just last year. And we now have a number of months until these are considered adopted, until they go into force, until they go into effect. And so with the meeting that's happening right now, the propaganda machine is using the same exact talking points that they used during the COVID pandemic to market their terror, to market their power grabs. You probably remember that no one is safe until everyone is safe, right? Here's a quick reel of some of the people saying that.
And we want to make sure that everyone understands that no one's safe till everyone's safe.
No one is 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 safe.
Nobody's safe.
No one is safe.
Nobody is safe.
This is a post 9/11 axiom. Safer, but not yet safe.
No one is safe. No one is safe. No one is safe. No one is safe from COVID-19 until everyone is safe.
If the whole world isn't safe, none of us are safe.
No one is safe.
No one is safe.
Nobody is safe
until we're all safe.
Health experts have been saying nobody is safe.
Nobody is safe until everybody is safe.
Nobody is safe.
The science is clear.
99.5% of people are safe and will survive COVID-19.
All right, now, we didn't compile that. And there are hours and hours of footage. All the mainstream news networks, all the political hacks, all the World Health Organization bureaucrats, the UN, etc., all blabbering the same thing. No one's safe until you're all safe. In other words, we need to vaccinate every single one of you if you ever want to be safe. And if not, you'll never be safe again. So, folks, the COVID-19 pandemic proved once and for all that no one is safe until everyone's safe. It's the same talking point they're using right now, actually in an explainer by the UN Foundation purportedly explaining what the World Health Organization is doing right now. They actually trotted out that talking point again. No one is safe until everyone is safe. So again, they're using the same tactics. They're using terror. They're using fear and they're using ignorance to try to get this through. Now, Tedros Ghebreyesus, an actual former leader of an actual Marxist terrorist organization, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. He was on the Politburo. He opened up this crazy summit that they started last week saying that we cannot simply carry on as we did before. He actually had a lot to say as they were opening this up. He said the pandemic accord that member states are now negotiating must be a historic agreement to make a paradigm shift in global health security, recognizing that our fates are interwoven. So this is just a recycled globalist talking point, right? It's a global problem, which therefore requires a global solution, and only the dictator-controlled World Health Organization, a UN agency, can actually provide this global solution. Now, he was joined by many other leading globalists. Antonio Guterres, a big advocate of the Great Reset, was there. He says, I hope current negotiations on pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response result in a strong multilateral approach that saves lives. Multilateral approach means globalist approach, right? Where an international organization will be doing the deciding. So these international health regulation pandemic amendments are absolutely huge, folks. And I want to go through a few of them. James Roguski, who we've interviewed on Conversations That Matter for the New American, just one of the top people following this debate. They make it very difficult to try to follow. But he put out a for kids version so that you could try to make sense of these amendments. Some of them are really, really interesting. So he puts it in for kids. He says in Article 1, the Bangladeshi government is proposing changing the meaning of the word recommendation so that it's not actually recommendation. It's basically you have to do whatever the WHO tells you. Okay, Article 2 says the Indian government wants the WHO to be allowed to terrorize everyone, to scare everyone, even when there's nothing to be afraid of. In Article 3, again, the Indian government is proposing changes that would allow the WHO not to have to respect your freedom and your rights when they're proposing solutions or recommendations, which are actually mandatory in terms of how you need to deal with your health. Article 4, now this is a big one. I want to stop for a moment and talk about this, because the Russian government, Vladimir Putin, is proposing an amendment that would require every national government to enact legislation that would create a national international health regulations focal point to implement the regulations that the WHO is coming up with. So here's the text. It says, state parties shall enact or adapt legislation to provide national IHR focal points with the authority and resources to perform their functions, clearly defining the tasks and function of the entity with a role of national IHR focal point in implementing the obligations under these regulations. In other words, folks, the WHO won't have to come out and directly enforce this stuff on you. The national IHR focal point would be authorized to implement these regulations in your country, whether that be the United States or some other place. And in fact, they already have one. The Department of Health and Human Services has the Secretary's Operations Center has the task of being the national focal point responsible for doing everything that the WHO wants. So folks, this stuff is really, really serious. Going back to some more amendments, Articles 13A and 42 got a number of governments proposing changes that would put the director general, in this case, the former communist terrorist leader, Tedros Ghebreyesus, in charge of the entire planet's health, including the ability to dictate the response to alleged health problems. In Article 36, a bunch of European officials want to change the rules so that someone could be forced to accept a vaccine or something else, or you're not allowed to travel or see your family and friends. Folks, this is absolutely unacceptable on every front. And second of all, it's totally unconstitutional, right? Our government, the U.S. government, does not have the constitutional authority to do these things. Therefore, it cannot delegate that authority to anyone else, much less a dictator club called the World Health Organization. Now, Matt Staver at the Liberty Council, he put out an alert, one of the best lawyers in the country. He said, WHO is going to be holding an important vote during its annual meeting in Geneva. If passed, the WHO will have unilateral authority to declare a pandemic, even over the objections of a nation, dictate how it will be addressed, and expand the control of this foreign body over 194 nations. He says no one should wield this much power, especially considering the shocking ties of WHO to communism and terrorism. There's also, folks, a lot of resistance growing in Congress. The Sovereignty Coalition just held a press conference in D.C. A whole bunch of members of Congress came together and others and actually are denouncing this. They put out a press release saying the WHO is a UN agency that is effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, as evidenced by, among other things, the manner in which the WHO's Director General, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, has relentlessly accomplished Beijing's biddings. The press release goes on to say that this includes advancing the CCP's interest in bringing about a post-constitutional America and global governance dominated by the CCP. Their hegemonic ambitions have no place for a powerful United States of America, for human freedom, or for personal sovereignty. So folks, really critical, this alliance. I've actually signed on as a signatory to the Sovereignty Coalition, so I'm proud to be a signatory on that. We've got to stop this. They go on to say that the factors make it hardly surprising that in the course of COVID-19, the WHO lied about the nature, origins, and effective responses to the Wuhan virus. It endorsed the China model of lockdowns, masks, and vaccine mandates and digital enforcement mechanisms, and the WHO approved the use of expensive and inadequately tested experimental and dangerous gene therapies as vaccines and the suppression of readily available, effective, and inexpensive treatments. Thanks in part to such misconduct, the pandemic has resulted in deaths of over 1 million Americans and many more elsewhere around the world, untold number of whom perished needlessly. They go on to say in this press release, folks, this is a brilliant press release. They say that given the WHO's appalling record, it is outrageous that the Biden administration is working to give the WHO and its director general more power over sovereign nations, including the United States. Yet the U.S. government officials are actively negotiating amendments to existing international health regulations and a new treaty governing future pandemic health emergencies of international concern. Ironically called fake, P-H-E-I-C. These accords would effectively repose in Dr. Tedros the authority to unilaterally dictate what constitutes an actual or a potential fake and to order how affected nations must respond. Another big part of this, folks, we warned you about this several times. They're working now on developing a global system to monitor and regulate travel. They don't want you to be able to move unless you have had all of your vaccines. They actually agreed, the G20 governments agreed to this in Indonesia late last year. Joe Biden was there, and so were many others. Klaus Schwab, the dictator wannabe running the World Economic Forum. I'm going to show you a clip of the Indonesian health minister talking about this in just a moment. But folks, this is what they're working on right now. Listen to this Indonesian health minister.
Acknowledged by WHO, if you have been vaccinated or tested properly, then you can move around.
All righty, folks. So there you have it. They don't want you to be able to move unless you do whatever the WHO says. They don't want you to cross borders, even leave your 15-minute city. It's hard to overstate the dangers of this, folks. But don't worry, it can be stopped. Right now, there's several options. I want to show you a couple of the members of Congress who spoke out about this during the Sovereignty Coalition press conference.
My colleagues behind me are here is to call attention to something that is very serious and threatens this country.
You know, the World Health Organization is a corrupt organization. They're nothing more than a puppet for the Chinese government.
Article 10 of the treaty says the U.S. would be obligated to provide 20% of our medical supplies.
The United States has donated billions of taxpayer dollars.
Why the heck are we even funded them in the first place? The United States is their largest contributor.
The reality is that international law does not trump our Constitution. Right. Biden cannot force Americans to follow laws and regulations not passed by our own federal government, and we will not tolerate and stand for this America Last agenda.
The Biden administration, honestly, I don't think they could pour water out of a boot if the instructions were written on the dadgum heel.
This is what Director General Tedros did. He's how he responded to the CCP's cover-up by praising the CCP for their transparency, despite internal documents showing WHO frustration with the CCP's failure to share critical data and information about the virus.
The communist Chinese government hid what was going on at that Wuhan lab. We have to get answers to that.
President Trump stood up to China, left the WHO, and restored American sovereignty. President Biden was quick to rejoin as soon as he took office because he is beholden to China.
If we continue to bow to globalist organizations who don't act in the interest of our own country, we will continue to be hurt.
Unelected foreigners with legislative power over American citizens would have our founders rolling in their graves.
This is not about public health. The WHO made it very clear they will censor anyone who does not agree with their agenda to control every aspect of people's lives. Under this plan, the Biden administration is adopting Marxism by distributing medicine based on equity. This is not what a constitutional republic looks like. This is a dictatorship, and we must defund the WHO and stop this radical agenda being put forward by the Biden administration.
The World Health Organization is the lapdog for the Chinese Communist Party, and they echoed every single lie of the CCP.
There is a section on surveillance, detailed surveillance of people, plants, animals and the environment, and also censorship, censoring, canceling anyone who disagrees with their narrative. How will they enforce it? They could enforce it the way that it was enforced in Canada, by simply cutting people off from their credit cards and their bank accounts. That's a good way to silence dissent.
In our country, we want to have as many decisions as possible made at the state and local level, right? President Biden's going the opposite way. It's important, however, for the press to educate the public what's at stake here.
We the people run this thing, so you should make your decisions with you and your family and your doctor regarding your business and your home, your interaction, whether or not you want to maintain personal interactions during a pandemic, whether your kid can go to school, etc. If you want to get a vax, get it. If you don't. That's called freedom. The World Health Organization should have zero impact regarding my freedom and yours.
So that's huge, folks. Now, the Republicans control the House of Representatives. The budget deals are happening right now. Republicans in Congress could just say no money for the WHO, no money to enforce anything from the WHO, no money to participate in anything that the WHO is doing. And it would bring a stop to all this. All of Biden's crying, all the fake media whining could not do one thing to extract that money from the American people if the House of Representatives won't go along with it. So one thing you could do right now is call up your member of Congress and ask them, what is going on? Why is there even the consideration that we might allow funding for this monstrosity? Another thing you can do, and this doesn't even involve Congress, is at the state level. Just a few weeks ago, we interviewed a great legislator from South Carolina, Representative Josiah Magnuson, about a great bill he's got, H-4246. This would be a bill to nullify the WHO at the state level, including their pandemic treaty and including their amendments to their regulations. And among other elements, this would ban the use of any government employees, government resources in the enforcement or the implementation of this ridiculous UN health scheme. Representative Magnuson said this.
So this bill is a way to, it's a tool to fight back, to use the really rightful remedies that we have available. You know, if this does go into effect, then we're not going to stand for it. We're already setting up a framework to resist this incursion on our American sovereignty and on the Bill of Rights.
So that's huge, folks. And any Republican state in America should be able to do this, right? There are no Republicans that I know of who think that we ought to be giving up our sovereignty to the WHO, to the UN, to govern international health things. So, folks, this is happening now as we speak. Get on the phone, get involved, get yourself up to speed, get a meeting with your congressman, get a meeting with your state representative and your state senator. This needs to be a top priority. They don't have, as I mentioned, as we've said in previous episodes, they don't have the constitutional authority to do this, even domestically, much less to hand that power off to a collection of gangsters, kleptocrats, and dictators. They just don't have that power. And even if they did somehow miraculously get this approved and ratified by the U.S. Senate, which is not going to happen, the fact that they don't have that power means they can't do that, right? Thomas Jefferson pointed out that they couldn't grant themselves new powers just by signing a treaty. What would be the point of having a constitution then? Reed versus Covert held this as recently as 1957. The federal government cannot grant itself new powers by signing on to treaties. It certainly cannot delegate powers that it doesn't have to a foreign government.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
And to complete today's show, let's go to our legislative and research team who discuss the latest on important legislation.
This is Christian Gomez with the New American Magazine. And today we'll be discussing the left's efforts to resurrect the Equal Rights Amendment, which was legitimately defeated decades ago. And joining us here today to discuss how the left is trying to make this Frankenstein monster, bring it back to the dead, is Peter Rakowski, our JBS Research Associate. So, Peter, the ERA, it was passed back in the 70s. They passed an extension, which was signed into law by, I believe, President Jimmy Carter. But during the extension period, no additional states ratified. In fact, some states rescinded their past ratifications. And we know that from the courts, the courts have affirmed. We don't need the court to tell us this, but the courts have affirmed that yes, a state can rescind its ratification. I mean, they can rescind a ratification of a constitutional amendment so long as that amendment has not yet been ratified in the Constitution. So we can't, for example, a state can't rescind its ratification of, say, you know, the 10th Amendment. It's already part of the Constitution. But if there's an amendment that's still circulating out there among the states for potential ratification and a state ratified, they can go back and rescind it as long as it's not part of the Constitution yet. But that aside, the ERA had an expiration date, did it? So how is it that the ERA is being brought back by the left? How are they even able to do this?
Well, the left simply, as they do on so many other topics, they simply want to ignore the clear text of the Constitution and just do what they want, just because it's convenient for their, you know, far-left extremist agenda. So they've introduced resolutions in Congress, Senate Joint Resolution Number 4 and House Joint Resolution Number 25, which would simply declare that the expiration date is, you know, hasn't actually happened. You know, that states can continue to ratify the ERA. And furthermore, the resolution says that the number of states that have ratified has already reached the 34 state, well, the 38 state threshold. So
it's a lot like that other bill in Congress introduced by Congressman Jody Arrington that's trying to aggregate all of the ConCon applications. Oh, we've already exceeded the number of states needed to apply for the convention, and the left, because that's a leftist tactic, to ignore rescissions. And here we have the left ignoring the rescissions of the ratifications for ERAs. Oh, we have more than enough. It should be part of the Constitution. It's long overdue.
Right, yeah, yeah. So Convention of States and these far-left activists really are using the same judicial activist strategy on this. So they want to ignore the states that have rescinded, and they want to count, you know, three states that have ratified the ERA after it expired, which in reality means that those ratifications are null and void. They they're just meaningless. But you know, that's what these leftists in Congress want to do. So Senate Joint Resolution Number 4, it actually has 52 senators as co-sponsors, including some very left-wing Republicans such as Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. So
I guess that's bipartisan for you. All the Democrats, or most of the Democrats, and the most liberal members of the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate.
Right. Yeah. So just a few weeks ago, the Senate actually voted 51-47 in favor of this resolution. But thankfully, actually, because of the filibuster, it actually failed because it needed 60 votes in the Senate. So this is what Congress wants to do. They want to completely ignore the Constitution. They want to completely ignore the original resolution where Congress passed the ERA all the way back in the 70s. You know, once again, which is unconstitutional, they want to ram this in because they know that if they pass the ERA, that they can get left-wing judicial activist judges to, push through their agenda on a whole range of policies.
Yeah. You know, one of the arguments that the left makes in favor of why the ERA ratification should, why we should ratify it, they claim it was ratified, but why it should officially be, why that ratification should be accepted, because it's not accepted, it's not part of the Constitution. One of the reasons that they use to justify it in their argument is they say, look at the 27th Amendment, right? This was the last amendment out of the Constitution, and it was actually one of the first ones proposed to the Constitution, because the Bill of Rights, what we now call the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, actually was a package of about 12 or so amendments that proposed out of Congress shortly after the ratification of the Constitution, and 10 of those were ratified by the states, then it became the Bill of Rights, but one of those wasn't ratified till decades, centuries later, actually. But what's the difference between the ratification of a 27th Amendment and, say, the ERA?
Well, with the ERA, Congress explicitly put a deadline for ratification. No other amendment or proposed amendment has this, but with the ERA, they actually set in the resolution, which was House Joint Resolution 208 of the 92nd Congress. It actually said, you know, if this proposed amendment is not ratified by this particular date, then it will simply expire. You know, then the effort to ratify it will be over.
And some liberals even have stood by that. Can you tell us a bit about some of the more well-known liberals, perhaps, who've endorsed what you just said as well?
Yeah, well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she was one of them who actually said that the expiration date is an actual expiration date. You can't ignore it or, you know, pretend that Congress never did it.
So even the notorious RBG, right, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she probably dashed the hopes of a lot of her fan base by saying, nope, you got to start all over again if you want to have this. And she's probably one of the people who would most wanted in the Constitution. In fact, I believe she did an interview with Scalia, and she was asked what amendment she'd like to see added to the Constitution. She said the ERA. But even though she's honest enough to say she wanted it in the Constitution, she knew that there's a right way to do it, and Congress set a deadline. So we missed the deadline. Well, they missed the deadline, her side. So she said, hey, you got to start all over again. But the left today, well, I guess they have the philosophy rules were meant to be broken mentality. So let's just ignore the rules and ratify it anyway, regardless what states have said.
Yeah, shows how extremist and Marxist that they're becoming, even by our standards and by Ruth Bader Ginsburg's standards.
Yeah. So, what would be some of the ramifications to our form of government, to liberty, if the ERA were ratified to the Constitution? Why is it so bad for those who may be watching and thinking, well, it's an equal rights amendment? What's so wrong with that?
Well, the amendment itself is extremely vague, and that's, the perfect gift for a left-wing activist judge. So, they'll use this, and by the way, the amendment would give total equality between men and women, which is actually really ridiculous because men and women are different. You can't claim that, men and women are completely the same in every way. So, for example, activist judges, they would strike down any laws that restrict abortion. They would impose unlimited abortion once again. They would strike down laws banning government funding of abortion. They would, strike down laws that, push back against the, so-called transgender agenda. So, sports competitions, men and women can take part in the same competition. That would be another excuse to do that. And then, also imposing the military draft for women. So those and a whole lot of other things, these left-wing activist judges would use that to impose unilaterally on the American people.
So essentially, if the ERA were to be ratified to the Constitution, we would be ratifying the woke agenda to the Constitution.
Right, exactly. That's what we would be ratifying.
Wow, that is extremely scary. So what can people do to stop the ERA? Well, to stop this attempt to resurrect it. I mean, it's already been defeated, but what can people do to stop this leftist scheme?
Right, yeah. So we have a legislative alert on jbs.org/alerts. And if you click on the federal alerts button, you'll see that alert really close to the top. So we have that alert, and we encourage everyone to use it. It just gives a really easy way to contact the U.S. representatives, the U.S. senators, and to tell them to oppose these resolutions and to make sure that they never pass.
Okay, thank you so much. You heard Peter Rutkowski yet again. jbs.org/alerts. Click on the federal alerts. Click on the stop ERA alert that we have there. Thank you so much for your time. As always, God bless.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And don't forget to visit betterwayconference.org and get your tickets to this wonderful event. Another reminder that freedom lovers around the world are coming together and demanding a better way. We'll see you tomorrow.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.